I'm Assistant Professor Jason Hare, and this is the Be Excited Podcast, where we break down the physician assistant profession from PA education to PA practice. Hey folks, this is our first episode of Be Excited. We started this podcast to provide context, learning, and information on the physician assistant profession in a time when online learning often substitutes for personal and in-person experiences. You may be wondering why we call this podcast Be Excited. It has been documented in various studies that one way to combat test anxiety and anxiety in general is to convert it into a very similar emotion, excitement. So after describing this technique to my students at the beginning of the year, I encourage them before every exam to convince themselves, or at the very least, say it out loud that they are excited. Just having them say, "I'm excited," can really help their test anxiety. I remind them before every exam in my classes, this Be Excited exhortation was the overwhelming favorite when I ask students to help me think of a name for this thing that we're doing today. We will have for this podcast, at least at the start, three tracks. Clinical medicine, which is focused on the PANTS blueprint for certification, and the PA jobs that treat those conditions. Interprofessional, in which we will talk to the people and professionals that PAs work with to make healthcare run. And finally, PA school, where we discuss student needs from PA school admissions to finding that first job. All right, so at this point, we will introduce our guest today, our first guest on Be Excited. This is Jeff Bright, who's a critical care PA. Jeff, would you mind introducing yourself just a little bit?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jason, for having me on the podcast. I'm honored and excited to be a part of this and to get involved. My name's Jeff Bright. I'm a critical care physician assistant. I work in the Pittsburgh area, but prior to this, I worked 2 years or so as a hospitalist physician assistant, in addition to providing an adjunct faculty role to the University of Pittsburgh.
Okay. Yeah, and Jeff is not only one of the alumni of the University of Pittsburgh, graduated in 2017. He was my student at the time, has graduated, moved on, but he still comes back and is an adjunct professor here in the program and provides my class, especially, with a lot of good and intensive learning in the topics that he knows best. So thank you for being here today, Jeff. So tell us about why you like and love, presumably, critical care medicine.
Absolutely. So ultimately here, I feel that at least for me, the draw to critical care came down to several things. The acuity of the patients, the opportunity to do procedures, and ultimately really the adrenaline rush of the environment, which is something I really enjoy. Additionally, I'd also say the autonomy I have, at least with my own particular position with overnight independent practice, allows me to really work to the fullest extent of that license. So all of those things combined, I would certainly argue that I do love critical care medicine itself.
And so you were a hospitalist previously. Tell me, if you describe to most people in medicine a hospitalist PA, or say that you're a hospitalist PA, you will get a variety of images popping into everyone's head about what that might look like, because there are hospitalists who work in a variety of different settings, from the very mundane to the very ridiculous on the far end of that. How would you say critical care medicine as a position, which seems to me to be a more focused kind of position, compares to that variety of hospitalist training and position that you work in?
Absolutely. Certainly at its very core, critical care medicine differs from hospitalist medicine in this for the sake of acuity. If that patient does require more advanced therapy, then they need to have escalation of care and then be transferred to the ICU. One big thing that I would also note as having experience in both would be perspective. I remember as a hospitalist physician assistant, particularly for rapid responses or this and that, you have one idea of the patient. You've known this patient for 4 days, but it is refreshing to have a new set of eyes. And now myself as that new set of eyes that focuses very dramatically on stabilizing patient airway, breathing, circulation. Let's dispo this patient. Let's get things moving. So that's a perspective change that I've had both of, which has certainly been rewarding to see.
For those of our listeners who are not perfectly familiar with the differentiation, can you tell us what the difference is between critical care medicine and the CCU and intensive care medicine and the ICU?
I think it comes down to what's the focus. So at least at the facility that I work, the ICU is essentially just one ICU. There is a cardiovascular unit that we have that primarily focuses on the open heart patients, the cardiac valve replacements, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that the patient's in the ICU or the CDU, then they're going to be under the either my service or the cardiothoracic surgeons.
Okay. And CDU is cardiac?
Cardiovascular unit.
CVU, sorry. Yeah. Yes. Cardiovascular unit. Okay. Excellent. Well, that's good to know. So my other question, one question I had for you on this topic was, what are your most common consults in that setting? Do you do a lot of consulting of other services from the CCU?
I would say primarily when it comes to our consult services, it would really have to be nephrology and infectious disease. We get some nasty bugs that we really need a second set of eyes on from the specialists themselves when it comes to ID. And certainly a lot of patients that have progressive renal failure or come in and need emergent dialysis. So nephrology is something that we lean on quite frequently.
Okay. And how about trauma patients, post-traumatic patients, car accidents, things of that nature? Do you get a lot of folks like that in that setting?
No. So fortunately, at least at the facility that I work in, it's not a trauma center. So if they come into the ER and they are a trauma patient, a motor vehicle accident, they're being triaged and sent downtown very quickly. Maybe every once in a while, our request is to help stabilize vent management, but that's few and far between. At least since I've been there, I haven't experienced that.
Okay. Moving on to some of the clinical topics here. You know, we often start in our lectures and classes with our PA students with, in that area, that particular area of medicine, what are the must not miss diagnoses? What, you know, of all the differential diagnoses that pop into your head when you see a patient, there are often a few that are really important, more emergent things that we need to get an answer on more quickly. So what are your most common must not miss diagnoses in these patients?
I would say my not must miss diagnoses would certainly be pulmonary embolism, sepsis, and encephalopathy. And particularly when it comes to encephalopathy, not miss large, massive CVA or status epilepticus.
Okay, so cardiovascular accidents, strokes, things of that nature certainly are going to have a significant impact on the patient's care. How do you assess those patients who come in with concern for a neurologic condition of that sort, like a CVA, or, as you say, status epilepticus that needs to be either broken or dealt with?
So encephalopathy itself can have a laundry list of different differentials on it. It's going to be something that's metabolic. Maybe it's a toxic encephalopathy itself from some sort of drug administration, whether intentional or unintentional, or it can be organic things like stroke and status epilepticus. If someone comes into the hospital and they're admitted to the ICU where they're a rapid response on the floor, so to speak, when I have an encephalopathy patient, I typically order basic lab work to try to further delineate what's going on, try to get some answers, and if needed, different types of imaging modality.
Okay. So what would your lab work, your blood work, presumably the first step would be trying to get a little bit of history and or physical exam on the patient, if possible, the ABCs, then moving on to blood work. So what would your blood work look like in that scenario?
Usually when it comes to blood work, typically CBC, a CMP, getting a TSH with concerns of maybe mixed edema or severe hypothyroidism, an ammonia level to be concerned with hepatic encephalopathy, and even a vitamin D level. Certainly, a lot of these metabolic conditions themselves can present with encephalopathy. So making sure we're not missing something fairly straightforward when it comes to underlying encephalopathy. Blood sugar at bedside is always a quick and dirty way to figure out why someone's obtunded. It's something that's usually, I wouldn't say usually, but can be overlooked and super easy to treat as well.
Okay. Yeah, and it's interesting that in my work in family medicine in a psych hospital, during my clinical practice, I had a very similar beginning workup, at least. You know, often we weren't moving on to imaging for those folks, or at least the imaging was going to be delayed by a little bit of time before we got a good picture of those patients. But those psych presentations coming into an emergency room department, you know, we had a set of labs. We had a broad set of labs that would kind of cover a lot of those things. There was a first psychosis breakup, for instance, and there was a workup that we would do for patients who were, say, depressed, and we're looking at their B12 levels. We're looking at anemia. We're looking at all kinds of systemic things that can potentially cause those psychiatric illnesses, can also cause, it sounds like, some of the acute mental status changes of an encephalopathy as well on the other side. So we're essentially looking for very similar things in a very different setting.
Absolutely.
Work setting. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. So the other ones here on the list, pulmonary embolism is another one there. And so the great pretender, as they call it, right? I think it's the great pretender that is
great
in your
pretender,
lecture.
I remember medical masquerader.
Right. So yeah, some funny names for a pretty serious condition, certainly. the number of presentations that can come up with. Do you see these pulmonary embolism cases? Presumably you get some of them that show up in your unit. Are those things that show up mid-pulmonary embolism? Do you already have a relatively set diagnosis before you get to that point? Or are you often doing the initial diagnosis of those folks?
So when it comes to these folks, I feel like I've seen them in all areas of that spectrum itself. Whether this is someone with a large submassive PE that does have some RV strain that's going for catheter-directed thrombolytics and then coming to the ICU after their intervention. Mm-hmm. That's someone that I get. Any patient that's been on the floor or had some dyspnea that we really can't figure out what's going on, let's say their chest x-ray is clear, but they're dyspneic and tachypneic and still something's brewing we might not know of, go ahead and consider PE.
Do you look at the extremities for a deep vein thrombosis in that scenario, a D-dimer and an ultrasound, a Doppler ultrasound, or are you going straight to the lungs in that situation?
Usually if, I'll tell you what, one of the NPs that's become a close friend of mine had always brought up the idea that if you think about it, go ahead and just order the CTA because you'll kick yourself in the end if you 2 days later they ended up having a PE and you missed it just for the sake of, no, that definitely couldn't be it. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, just order the CTA. I usually, if I'm that concerned about PE, I'll forego the Dopplers and the dimer, and I'll get that later on in a couple hours. But if I'm that concerned, I'm just going to order the CT angio.
Okay. So presumably the reason for the variety of presentation there is that so many different areas of day-to-day life can cause a DVT, pulmonary embolism, including, you know, being on the unit after surgery, post-op. Folks can have some moving into the area of the lung, lower extremity, folks from home, people who are not up and moving around a great deal have the potential for that DVT and pulmonary embolism. So being at home, being in the hospital, there's a variety of ways in which those things can present to you. So what's your go-to imaging on the pulmonary embolism side of things?
Oh, 100% I'll go with the CT angiogram of the chest. Mm-hmm. It's just the criterion standard as of today when mm-hmm. it comes to identifying and diagnosing pulmonary embolism. If you have to, you can always consider a VQ scan, but usually in the folks that I'm seeing that need an answer now, I'll usually go for the CT mm-hmm. angio and risk stratifying, but take the hit when it comes to their renal function if that's a concern.
If it's necessary, yeah. And the ventilation perfusion scan is that, you know, oftentimes I find myself talking to students and talking about things that they need to know. But we don't really see them as much anymore. And the ventilation perfusion scan is one of those things. I feel like I don't see a lot of that in the community or in the lab work or in electronic medical records. I don't see that showing up very often anymore.
I would certainly agree. We don't order them very often, especially working with the palm crit folks that I'm with. A lot of the outpatient palm folks will order VQ scans for chronic thromboembolic mm-hmm. pulmonary hypertension, just as the gold standard there. But when it comes to an inpatient medicine perspective, usually I don't order them. Unless patient has dramatic contraindication to heparin or anticoagulation, but I'm really concerned that they might have a PE, I'll order one. But more often than not, I'll probably just go with a CT angio or nothing.
Excellent. Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about shock, that this, especially the septic shock side of things. So shock can have its own set of etiologies, causes that can be really concerning and obviously have high morbidity and mortality associated with them. But if I recall, you said that you had a relatively set approach to those. And can you tell us about that?
So any patient who comes in with shock, ultimately here, we need to identify what's the underlying etiology. Is it cardiogenic from a big MI? Is it obstructive from a pulmonary embolism? Or ultimately, is it sepsis? So any patient that comes in with shock, unless I'm 100% certain, and in still some cases, more often than not, I'm going to start empiric antibiotics. More often, we hear folks that perhaps missed the sepsis that was brewing, and then 2 days later, and unfortunately, we can't backstep from that. So I'm more of the mindset of start empiric antibiotics, even though you know it's cardiogenic. You can always take them off 2 days later, but you don't get burned for missing that roaring UTI that caused their cardiogenic shock.
Right. So a presumptive infection in this case is something that you're going to go after immediately, empirically treat. Can you tell me what kind of antibiotics are you using in that initial stage for that broad spectrum most of the time?
So if patients are coming to the ICU and they do have shock and now they're on vasopressors and we've fluid resuscitated them, now I'm starting to think about empiric antibiotic coverage. Certainly, I'm more of the adage of go big or go home, especially when it comes to these folks. I'm definitely adding vancomycin. And at my other facility when I was a hospitalist, they were big fans of Zosyn. Here over at the facility that I now staff at Pima is usually the go-to. Just a little bit more narrow coverage. We're avoiding the use of Zosyn unless we absolutely have to. Mm-hmm. So if I really have to, I'm probably going Vanx, FPM, and metronidazole or Flagyl.
Okay. So that's a good point to make when it comes to being a physician assistant. You know, the one thing that I think that makes physician assistants sometimes a little different from folks who might be an MD or DO in those cases is that moving from place to place is more common for physician assistants because our licensure is more general. It provides us with the latitude to work in a variety of settings, a wide variety of settings, which is, you know, certainly different from what you would see in most MDs. And so moving from place to place, seeing the kinds of institutional changes and institutional protocols and policies that really impact PA medicine is one of those things that I feel like is underappreciated. Knowing that when you walk into your hospital on any given day, privileges at multiple hospitals, you might walk into one and the standard and the folks that you work with, the infectious disease committees, for instance, who put together the protocols for antibiotic treatment, may actually be very different than another hospital's institutional policies and procedures. While the first line treatment is often thought of as being very similar, you may be in a different geographic area. You may have areas where one antibiotic is not preferred. It may be a personal preference for some physicians in smaller practices, private practices, for instance. I've worked with physicians previously that one gentleman didn't like clarithromycin at all. He did not like it at all. So we were either on the low end of that empiric spectrum for prevention, or we were going straight to vancomycin once we got past that. So I think that's an underappreciated aspect of physician assistant medicine sometimes. And certainly, you know, I'm sure you've experienced a little bit of that between your hospitalist time and your critical care time.
Oh, certainly. I remember even as silly as Tylenol. I remember at the one facility that I used to work at, we'd use IV Tylenol or Affirmev and we'd use it. And then I tried to use it at the new hospital and you would have thought, I said the most horrific thing ever when the pharmacist looked at me and said, no, we will not order IV Tylenol. He's like, the bioavailability is identical and one is dramatically more expensive. And so it's just little things like that where from institution to institution, you are going to have a little bit of change.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. And Tylenol is one of those things often that gets, well, it gets tossed around as it comes in and out a little bit over time. But certainly the toxicity issues with Tylenol, once you reach that line, that toxic line with Tylenol, I worked in orthopedics for a time. The physician that I worked with, the orthopedic surgeon, would not give a combination opiate and Tylenol medication because patients often don't think about that combination, right? And so Tylenol is another good example of ways in which an individual practitioner, an individual institution will have their own ways of doing things when it comes to these things. And so, yeah, it's good to point that out, I think, today. Let's talk about your most common diagnoses in the CCU. I know that they include at least one or two that we've already spoken of a little bit today.
So I would say the three big diagnoses that I see rather routinely, and unfortunately do have a very high rate of mortality, would be COVID pneumonia and subsequent ARDS, septic shock, and post-cardiac arrest with anoxia.
Okay. We already talked a little bit about septic shock, certainly, and the approach with antibiotics first. Let's talk a little bit about the post-cardiac arrest with anoxia side of things. So this is presumably anoxia because of lack of perfusion. All areas of the body have experienced that lack of perfusion during that time. But what kind of things do you go after that anoxic period and that lack of perfusion to the heart?
So similar to as we spoke before, that time is brain. And a really big things that come down to is how long was the downtime during cardiac arrest. So some folks may be down for less than 10 minutes and may have a better outcome, although not guaranteed, compared to folks that are down for 20, 30, 40 minutes, an unknown downtime period, and as a result have a poorer neurologic outcome. Additionally, something that we need to consider is trying to preserve that brain as much as we can. There's been some articles that suggest against target temperature management and therapeutic hypothermia. Still up for debate whether or not it's worthwhile or more harm than good, so to speak, but something that we always need to consider, as well as seizures and posturing that occurs as a result of anoxia.
During that post-cardiac anoxic period of time, workup look any different for that anoxia, the cerebral side of things, the encephalopathy potential after those kinds of anoxic injuries than it does after a CVA, a stroke, a cardiovascular accident of some sort?
I would say the big thing that it comes down to is how do they respond to our current therapy? Are they someone that's post-arrest moving all four extremities, they're able to communicate and follow commands, then perhaps we don't go down that road as dramatically or as intensely, so to speak. But this is someone that remains obtunded, comatose, is not sedated on mechanical ventilation. Now we need to consider things like a non-con CT of the brain, an MRI, an EEG.
On the cardiovascular side of things, we talked a little bit about our consult services available to you in the CCU. Is the cardiac folks a big source of consult for you there?
I would say cardiology, nephrology, and infectious disease are probably our most common consult services. When it comes to someone that is post-PCI or had a balloon pump or an impeller or something in that place and needs further management, cardiology needs to be on board.
Okay.
If it's infectious disease, and certainly we have a variety of different nasty bugs and need the specialties eyes on them, then infectious disease definitely needs to be on board.
So if you have a patient who is experiencing a cardiovascular accident or myocardial infarction while they are in, let's say they're in their bed and you're concerned about a brewing myocardial infarction, and this is something that I've always been curious about, we call a code at my hospital and your team is who shows up, the critical care folks from the hospital across the street. And so my question for you is then, if you have something brewing along those lines, are you then going to respond to that in-house? Are you going to basically take care of it of your own volition? Or do you call the code and have the cardiovascular team show up in those moments? Because you're the team in my hospital.
So is this a stemming that we're concerned with, or is this a cardiac arrest on the floor?
For the sake of discussion, yeah, let's go with the STEMI, with the ST elevation myocardial infarction, presumably the more severe version of that.
Deal. So if I see, let's say it's a rapid response in my hospital, but either way, I've responded to a patient, we're concerned that they're having a STEMI, we get an EKG at bedside there, it does look concerning for it, I'll call cardiology, or interventional cardiology rather. They'll activate the quote STEMI alert, which will bring in not only them, but members from the cath team that will all respond if they're, let's say it's middle of the night, or if they're during the day, they're already there. And that patient will go directly from that bed straight down to the cath lab where they can have intervention done.
And so are you ordering, as this is going on, troponins, which are the cardiac enzymes released during one of these cardiac events?
So usually if let's say a patient has classic presentation, I look at their EKG at bedside and identify ST changes and reciprocal changes as well. I'll call cardiology and get the ball rolling. I might have lab come by and do a CBC, a CMP, and troponins in the meantime, but ultimately the priority is getting them downstairs. Once they're done and they can get back to me so we can reevaluate, more often than not, do a bedside ultrasound myself and order a formal one, order troponins, maybe even CKMB as well,
okay,
and to kind of go from there.
So you're ordering more cardiac enzymes than just the troponin. So troponin I, presume, in that scenario?
I believe so. We've recently got the high sensitivity
troponins. Full assay, yes.
Which, okay, to be quite honest, I think they cause more harm than good in some circumstances.
Very sensitive, right?
Yeah.
Hypersensitive in some cases. And the CKMB is something that you also order. So you're looking for the longer term increase.
Absolutely. So it depends on the attending that I'm working with. And quite frankly, the mood as well. But sometimes I will order CKMB just to kind of see if there's a secondary peak in trend that maybe we missed before. Mm-hmm. If troponin's on the descent, so to speak, but now they're having recurrent symptoms, maybe if I'm trending CKMB, I can still get a better idea of what's going on.
It sounds like the EKG is really your primary initiator for this process.
I would say at least when I just see them on the floor, it's happening right in front of me, most certainly.
Yeah.
What's their presentation? What are their biomarkers? What are the EKG? If I can get two of the three and it looks like a good case, I'm calling cardiology.
The next step then in the hospital would be the cath lab, so PCI in that instance. Mm-hmm. Okay, so percutaneous intervention where they're running a stent into the area through the femoral artery, presumably all the way up into the heart, and allowing that and opening up those vessels so that blood flow can be restored to that area. I often get a lot of discussion with my students about the difference in the indication for PCI versus the indication for doing a CABG, which is a coronary artery bypass graft. It's a difficult thing to grasp sometimes that the CABG is kind of a longer term thing. If we've got the time and the ability to hold off on that for maybe 24 to 48 hours, then that's when the CABG takes place.
I would most certainly agree with that. In most cases, when patient does undergo cardiac catheterization, we can either do PCI right on the spot if it's one, two, maybe three lesions that need to be placed. If there is for the most part, and again, I'd have to double check what the current CABG indications are at this time. But if it's multi-vessel disease and they're long segments and putting in 40, 50, 60 stents certainly isn't reasonable, then maybe that's a patient that no intervention is done. They'll continue on heparin with very urgent cardiothoracic consultation, who then can start to decide whether this is an emergent CABG patient or can we treat them for their end STEMI right now and then do a CABG in 2 days, 2 weeks, they name
it. Right.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is we've moved into other areas of medicine from these generalist perspectives. And the CCU is an area where you're looking not just at the overall patient stability in the moment and looking at their status, are they critical or not, but also looking at lungs. We've already talked about the lungs, the heart, we're talking about the kidneys, we're talking about the brain. You know, so this is a kind of a full body perspective on an emergency side of medicine, really, and maintaining that patient's life. And so I can imagine in those moments why that is such a draw for you to do this particular job.
I liked it that much, as you get to be know a little bit about everything. What is that phrase? Master of all, knower of
Jack of all, master of none.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
there you
it.
Go.
And that's something that I really enjoyed. I didn't like the idea of forgetting something that I spent 2 hard years working on and then unfortunately forgot it all.
I definitely agree with that. So let's talk about the COVID pneumonia cases. I presume you've had a great deal of those. What percentage of your emergency room at the moment are COVID cases?
I would say right now we have a 20-bed ICU, and to be quite honest, we're at capacity. We have 20 patients more often than not. Sometimes we can make some moves, so to speak, and have 12 to 15, but unfortunately, very quickly, they are going back up to 20 beds.
Right.
Of those 20 beds, I'd probably say 75% is COVID pneumonia.
Wow.
On the vent or soon to be, unfortunately.
And that's come and gone, presumably, over the course of the pandemic, I assume, over the last couple of years. But it is really interesting. So you're saying COVID isn't a hoax?
I would certainly say not.
Okay. All right. These patients coming into you, and this is one of those things that I think a lot of folks have difficulty grasping. It is usually the secondary issues that COVID causes in those patients, whether it's vascular damage or pneumonia is a big one, right? And so most of the cases of mortality and patients who die in care, during care in the hospital, are pneumonia patients.
Absolutely. So a lot of these patients, certainly COVID is the initial flick of the snowball, so to speak, but it's the progressive inflammation, the fibrosis, the ARDS, the renal failure, the secondary bacterial pneumonia, the pulmonary embolism, the GI bleed from being on anticoagulation that unfortunately is ultimately what ends the patient.
That snowball running downhill can turn into a lot of different things in that scenario. Have you in your CCU been putting a lot of patients prone during that time?
Usually we will, unless there's a dramatic contraindication or relative contraindication, such as, let's say, if I have a femoral temporary dialysis catheter, those could kink very often. I'm probably not going to prone that person.
Okay.
If there's concern for any type of intracranial bleed, but I can't take that patient to get imaging just because they are so unstable, I'm not going to prone them. But more often than not, if we have a COVID patient that's on the vent, they're getting proned. Usually 16 hours on, 8 hours off.
And so that pneumonia that you're seeing in those patients is a secondary bacterial pneumonia in those patients?
It's hit or miss. We have some folks that are genuinely pure COVID pneumonia and ARDS that results from it. Some folks have a concomitant bacterial infection. Some folks have been pure COVID pneumonia for the longest time, and we've had them for 2 weeks. And then they get a bacterial pneumonia as well on top of it. But more often than not, it's a little bit of everything.
Your treatment lineup for a COVID pneumonia, and I want to preface this by noting that the entire time that you would be treating a patient with COVID pneumonia, and presumably even to walk onto that unit at this point, as it is in my psych hospital, to walk onto that unit wearing a PAPR at this point, the overhead with the air supply into the helmet, or are you gowned, gloved, mask with...
Usually, if I'm going into one of those COVID rooms, I'll usually wear an N95 or an N100. Mm-hmm. Those are just the ones that have been most available and easier to distribute, at least at my facility. Mm-hmm. I'll usually wear one of those with a surgical mask over top of it. I have some rec specs that I wear that I enjoy wearing rather than a face shield, a hairnet and gown and gloves. And usually that's the go-to for us right now.
One of the challenges to me, and I've had to gone into our COVID positive unit several times to see patients. The challenge for me is you're really seeing patients through a lot of layers to get to that point. And even getting your stethoscope out can sometimes be, or a pen light is a challenge in that scenario sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
So you're treating that patient. Let's say you get a patient into the CCU. How severe is that? What are the numbers that really add up to bringing them into your unit at this point?
To be honest, it really comes down to judgment call for a lot of them. COVID has certainly changed ICU indications and the requirements to transfer down simply based on bed availability as well as nursing staff ratios. So perhaps realistically, a patient may more easily be brought down to the ICU for closer observation, perhaps stays on the floor a little bit longer. And that's just unfortunately the nature of the beast right now.
Certainly.
My biggest thing is, does this patient need to be put on the vent right here, right now? Are they going to be ventilated within the next 24 to 36 hours, or it's a significantly high risk for a poor outcome? Those are three of my generic ways of saying, you know what, I need to bring this person down. And just refractory hypoxia. So if someone comes in, they can't get their SATs over 85, they're on maximal settings of BiPAP. Yeah. I've already recommended escalating through oxygen therapy, and now we're on the extent of BiPAP that we have. Usually that person, I'm going to bring them down because they have such a high risk for being put on the vent.
Yeah, absolutely. And so those patients at 85 or below are going to be presumably significantly ill at that point. Although I have seen some stories of folks who were relatively stable in those moments and able to maybe not walk into the ICU, but close to it. Making that decision to move in that direction and knowing that that patient's morbidity associated with COVID is going to be significant. So do you have significant conversations with families before moving to the vent in those situations?
You try to the best you can, certainly because visitation policies have been ever changing throughout the last several years or so. It makes seeing their family members so challenging. So patients, families, understandably want good communication.
Right.
If I have time to, I'll try at the very least to make time to contact family, tell them of their transfer, and confirm code status. That's been a big thing over the last several years is confirm code status, tell them that their loved one unfortunately has a high risk and is going to be placed on the ventilator, and telling them the risks associated, including cardiac arrest, peri-intubation. I'll give you a call when everything's all done.
Okay. And have you ever brought a family in to talk to the patient? Or presumably that's a difficult thing to do by the time they get to the CCU, but have you ever brought family in to talk to the patient, say goodbye? The issue there is that when you intubate, presumably you're putting them on sedation for that time, and they may not be able to speak with them after that point. And given the mortality rate of patients who make it to that point, it's pretty significant. So is that something that you've had to deal with as well?
It's been challenging. The biggest thing here is institution policies when it comes to visitation. Mm-hmm. They're ever changing. But for a while now, there have been times where there was no family members for a COVID patient, end of story, period. So you could quickly try to set up FaceTime, phone call, something that we tried to do. But unfortunately, that patient has a negative pressure room. They likely have very high inspiratory pressures on that BiPAP. It's very loud in that room. They're probably obtunded. So it makes it challenging, especially to say goodbye.
Yeah. And so not being able to say goodbye, not having the mental status capability to actually to speak with folks in the family, I can imagine that has the potential to be a particularly emotional moment to deal with.
Yeah.
And I'm sure your patients and those families appreciate having you of all people to step in and give them some sense of what's going on. And your communication style, I'm sure, fits that really well and helps those folks out to whatever extent possible.
Thank you.
That's not an easy thing to do. So I guess what I'm saying is thank you for your service when it comes to COVID and the pandemic these days. So let's move on, if you're willing to do so, to a couple more of our other significant cases here that we have discussed. You know, we talked about the hypoxic and hyperbaric respiratory failure with folks. Can you give us an example of a picture of a patient who is in that type of respiratory failure?
So particularly when we have folks on the floor or even in the ICU that have of high risk for decompensation, we order arterial blood gases very, very often. Some folks and some providers like daily ABGs. That's simply a style preference. I think other folks, including myself, like to be able to do something with that knowledge and that information that you get with an ABG. Mm-hmm. But ABGs is what I'm getting is something that's very frequently done. Mm-hmm. And so identifying PaO2 and PCO2 and identifying what type of therapy is best to help to improve their overall oxygenation and carbon dioxide load.
And so with the ABGs, you're getting the pH, you're getting the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood. So how much oxygen are they able to get into the bloodstream? And how much of the CO2 that is being produced by their body is actually being removed by the lungs on the far end? And is bicarb as part of that as well?
Yeah.
And so those ABGs are arterial blood gases drawn usually from a femoral line in those cases?
More often than not, they're usually radially done. If they're a patient in the ICU and they have an arterial line already placed, usually we try just for the sake of institution policy, go radial rather than femoral. But usually if they already have an arterial line, then we'll just draw it straight from there. If they're up on the floor, they'll try to do an arterial line or a radio ABG, just with the RTs. I don't know if the RTs can do femoral sticks, but if there's a tough one on the floor and we need an ABG, then I'll usually just grab the longer needle of the ABG kit, do a quick femoral stick, and then be done with it.
And respiratory therapists, RTs are certainly a profession that has been a frontline kind of profession that we are seeing really called to the forefront these days during the COVID pandemic, but also for a variety of other things. You know, and respiratory therapy is also providing care for our folks in the CCU for things like acute hypoxic respiratory failure. ARDS, we mentioned that briefly earlier. ARDS being that buildup of fluid outside of the alveoli, between the alveoli in the lungs and the bloodstream itself, which presents a fluid barrier to that oxygen making its way into the bloodstream, and of course the carbon dioxide making its way back out of that bloodstream. What is your go-to treatment? So are you treating the initial infection in those cases, the initial issues during those respiratory failure moments with ARDS, or are you going after ARDS itself with pressures?
I would say the big thing here when it comes to treating ARDS is trying to get the source under control. Mm-hmm. More often than not, it ends up being infection and not necessarily pneumonia all the time. Sometimes we can have ARDS from other inflammatory producing conditions, pancreatitis being one of them. But trying to get the source under control, most importantly. We'll try to keep these patients dry if we can, renal function permitting, trying to use diuretics.
Right.
And then lastly, when it comes to folks that more than likely are on the ventilator, high PEEP and low tidal volumes, as per the big ARDS study that was done years ago.
So we're not putting a significant waveform on their ins and outs of that air going into the lungs.
Absolutely, yeah. Trying to reduce baro and volute trauma as much as we can. Mm-hmm. I remember a physician that I worked with years ago always kind of classified it and tried to describe it as a brown paper bag, those alveoli, that if we can fold up that lunch bag nice and neat every day, it's going to last a little bit longer. If you blow that thing up and crinkle it up, and then blow that thing up and crinkle it up again, you're going to destroy those desmosomes, you're going to destroy those tight junctions,
yes,
and cause worse inflammation and just completely cascade this ARDS even worse.
I'd love to hear the terminology that I use in my physiology and pathophysiology classes brought to clinical use. I love it. Fantastic. And I probably didn't teach you any of those. No. I'm just talking about my current.
I think you did the ARDS lecture for what it's worth.
Yes. Actually. Okay. So we talked a little bit about septic shock in the typical patient that we see with septic shock. Let's talk about ATN and progressive acute renal failure.
So something that we see very often in the ICU is acute tubular necrosis. And more often than not, it's because of septic shock, a pre-renal state, and then is turned into what was just a pre-renal AKI, then becomes ischemic ATN, and then, unfortunately, worse and worse urine output, become oliguric, and then require dialysis.
We're referring to the bloodstream before it gets to the kidney, before that blood is taken to the kidney pre-renally and filtered inside the kidney is where we're seeing the difficulty that then results in the kidney having AKI, is acute kidney injury, which is a relatively short-term, if we're lucky, kind of an injury to the kidney and its ability to filter. So oliguria being the far side of that, which means very little urine being produced, or in some cases, especially if we're moving toward hemodialysis and end-stage renal failure, we're talking about anuria, which means the patient is not producing any urine through those kidneys. What are your first steps when you're working with a patient who you're concerned for that ATN and ARF?
I would say the big thing here is trying to identify the source and what's driving this kidney injury in general. Mm-hmm. Is this our straightforward AKI? It's pre-renal. It's hypovolemia and hypoperfusion mediated, and simply we just need to improve their blood pressure, give them some volume, and hopefully we start to turn in the right direction.
Okay.
However, also, as you can imagine, we can also have a variety of other types of kidney injuries. Is this someone that I need to get some imaging of their belly to see if it's obstructive uropathy? And unfortunately, now it's an obstructive AKI.
Mm-hmm.
Get urine studies just to see if this is truly ATN or AIN in the setting of eosinophils and different medications. But ultimately here, it's trying to see where their urine output settles in 3, 4, 5 days, keeping a close eye to that urine output. And when that urine output starts to go, maybe give a day or two of like a Lasix trial. But ultimately here, you know what's going to happen. And they usually end up on dialysis.
So if in this situation, it sounds as if a lot of those patients, and we talk about this a lot in different areas of clinical medicine, patients who are post-op, patients who are post-trauma, let's say, and have a couple of days stay in the hospital, the old saw about we need that patient to start making urine and we sure that they're making urine before they walk out the door. Do you see many of those cases where we haven't gotten to the point where they're making urine from their AKI or that they're lapsing into renal failure during those times?
I would say, I remember as a hospitalist, that was always a big thing is, mm-hmm. especially post-op patients, are they making urine? Please make sure you bladder scan them. If they need a Foley, put a Foley in. When it comes to patients that end up in the ICU, they already have a Foley in. We're getting very strict eyes and nose, and we can kind of see, are they actually making urine? Let me give them some volume, see if that helps. They weren't responsive. Mm-hmm. Maybe as a last-ditch effort, you try the Lasix just to see if we can stimulate some urine production.
Interesting.
But at the end of the day, when they start to become oliguric, anuric, we've already started that descent into considering hemodialysis.
Do you miss the days of having a number of beds, more beds associated with things like kidney issues as opposed to COVID pneumonia patients?
It's tough. I certainly enjoy the variety.
Yeah.
Even when the COVID wave, sometimes they decrease a little bit and you get a little bit more variety. It's always exciting. It's refreshing, sick as that sounds.
Well, I can imagine. You know, the variety is the spice of life. And I think a lot of PAs appreciate about their jobs and being able to see a wide variety of things. And, you know, recently it feels like, as we said before, that thing that really overhangs a lot of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis in medicine is generally speaking COVID. How about the secondary bacterial pneumonia? So a lot of the cases, presumably we're talking about necrosis that leads to a secondary bacterial pneumonia in those patients. Are you more often seeing the patients who are inpatient, the patients who are hospital acquired, or is this mostly community acquired?
I would say when we have a secondary bacterial pneumonia, and I'll generalize for the sake of our podcast, usually these folks have already been inpatient for a while, and then they've developed a bacterial pneumonia on top of this.
So this is
nosocomial.
It poses its own set of increased challenges for those patients.
Oh, yeah. It changes the antibiotic coverage that we need to do. Usually MRSA and CFA and Pseudomonas are the big bugs that I'm looking to cover, especially with my antibiotics. And for someone who was, let's say, post-op left knee, they're looking to get out of here, and before you know it, now they have pneumonia, now they have an AKI, now they're in new onset AFib, and we got a slew of new problems for you, and you just came in to get your knee replaced.
Right, and that convalescent time in a hospital after a surgery, like a total knee replacement or something of that nature, a hip replacement, is one of those things that is kind of underappreciated, you know, and I think, unfortunately, the shorter stays in hospitals these days make that convalescent period a little bit less relaxed, certainly. We're sending patients home more early. On the other hand, those hospital-acquired infections the nosocomials are less likely to occur because we're giving them less time in the place where all the sick people live.
Absolutely. I've always been a big proponent of all things within reason, but being a little bit more aggressive when it comes to discharge, especially as a hospitalist more particularly, is get these folks out of here. The longer you stay here, the sicker you're going to get. And that's just the unfortunate reality of having comorbidities and being elderly in the hospital, the quicker I can get you out of here safely, the better.
But the last one on the list I think is interesting, pneumothorax and or pneumomediastinum subcutaneous emphysema. It surprises me that that makes the list, actually. But so I'm curious to hear what sort of scenarios you see often with that involve those kind of lung conditions and chest wall conditions.
I'll tell you what, I haven't done as many pigtail chest tubes than I have in the last 2.5 years. And it's all COVID. Frequently see pneumothorax and even pneumomediastinum and sub-Q air that really took a dramatic increase once COVID hit. Unfortunately, just with the damage that ensues as a result of the viral infection.
That's caused by the virus itself. And obviously you're being very, very careful with pressures being put into the lung with BiPAP and PEEP. But this is more of a damage, a necrotic damage being caused by the infection itself.
I would even argue that because of the viral infection and the inflammatory cascade as a result, they require such high levels of non-invasive ventilation with CPAP and BiPAP. So because of that, and they have to be on CPAP of 15, 20, BiPAP of 25 when it comes to their IPAP, that unfortunately you end up blowing out one of the lungs.
Okay.
We've even seen a lot of pneumomediastinum and sub-Q air without presence of pneumothorax. Just those tracheal rings start to have so much pressure in them that we get some air that starts to leak out and then fill the subacute spaces.
That's unfortunate and one of those underappreciated, I think, things, even amongst other medical professionals, understanding that really you're pushing the physiology of that patient when they have COVID, or when they have these conditions, sometimes to the point where what you're doing for them is reaching a limit. You're reaching a limit where you know, it's kind of a risk reward thing, where if you are doing more damage than good at that point, then you have to back off a little bit. But again, they may need that increased pressure and that increased oxygen presence in the lungs to help them to survive.
Absolutely. It's such a tough balance when their respiratory requirements are of a BiPAP of 25 over 15, so to speak, but you know that they already have pneumomediastinum, they're going to blow out one of their lungs any day now. It's a fine line, but unfortunately, the mortality and morbidity at the very least ends up being pretty high for those folks that get into those predicaments.
Mm-hmm. So for my physiology geeks out there, we have our metabolic acidosis, metabolic alkalosis, respiratory acidosis, and respiratory alkalosis in our four corners. Where do most of these patients, the COVID pneumonia patients, for instance, where do they end up most of the time? And are they able to compensate for that? Are you able to compensate for that?
I would say for the most part, if I had to pick one of the four, it's a respiratory acidosis.
Okay.
Because of their poor gas exchange. And unfortunately, because of becoming increasingly lethargic and obtunded, they become hypercarbic very quickly.
Okay.
Not to mention if they have underlying lung disease and COPD to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So not blowing off the CO2 becomes the big issue in that instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And then unfortunately, because of that, despite BiPAP, they may require some extra TLC when it comes to mechanical ventilation.
Thank you for that. Some great indications and pathologies to discuss there. I say great, I mean unfortunate, but really interesting stuff. PA education in general is a generalist perspective. That we start off from that jack of all, master of none, as we said before, kind of perspective. Where I live in my family medicine practice and primary care, internal medicine, your hospitalist practice certainly, and your CCU practice certainly land somewhere on that continuum. That's where we start our education in physician assistant school. So tell me, when is a generalist likely to need to progress to the kind of care that you give in your service?
I would say acuity and ultimately the need for more advanced therapies. So someone that is becoming more sick, they're starting to decompensate, whether it's respiratory perspective, they need mechanical ventilation, whether it's a hemodynamic perspective, and that they need vasopressor therapy. Those are the two big ones that then end up driving folks that do require ICU level care.
Pressures and monitoring.
Exactly. And monitoring and nursing ratios ultimately.
Ventilation, yeah.
Which has certainly been a sore subject for most with nursing ratios.
Oh, certainly. In every hospital in the world, I think, at this point. So the most common handoff for you then from a generalist is probably going to be coming from your emergency medicine counterparts down the hall in the emergency room.
Certainly. Okay. That's probably the most common handoff that I'll get, is having a call out or a page out to the ICU. I'll come down and already have looked at the labs and done some homework. Come down, see the patient, talk to the ER provider, and try to get a good game plan as to, do they need to come to the ICU or can they go to the floor and can give me a call back later if they need.
You had mentioned that you have a cardiac unit in your hospital. So if you have a post MI patient, are they more likely to go to the cardiac care unit or are they more likely to come to you in critical care?
Those dynamics are also always changing in terms of what types of patients can be in this cardiovascular unit, so to speak. More often than not, if a patient is hemodynamically stable, they've had an intervention done, they have no assist devices, Impella, balloon pump, those folks, in my opinion, can go to a high telemetry floor. But unless they need vasopressor therapy, they're in complete heart block, they're doing having a pacer on board, then they should probably go to the cardiovascular ICU unit.
Really, one of the big considerations these days is, where's the bed? What bed do we have available?
Exactly,
yeah. Is that bed going to be enough or, you know, intensive enough in its care for that patient to actually, I don't want to say do the job, but be comfortable with the care of that patient in those moments?
Agreed.
Yeah. Anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I think we did a nice job of covering a little bit of everything and a nice introduction to kind of get us started. I'm excited to see where the podcasts go and to keep things rolling forward. I appreciate being on board. It's an honor.
Well, we'll certainly be having you back as soon as possible. The list of topics include a lot of things that you are well versed in, and I think we'll bring you back for as many as we possibly can during these next couple of years. Many thanks to our esteemed guest today, Jeff Bright, PAC. Always a pleasure, and I'll see you in the classroom before too long, I'm sure. That's it for now. Be sure to check out the podcast website, beexcitedhq.com, all one word, for more episodes, show notes, and transcripts. Email us at contactbeexcited all one word, at gmail.com with any questions, comments, suggestions for future episodes. We appreciate those. Any comments that you might have. And of course, follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Excited Podcast for news, new episode notifications, and maybe an occasional picture. Thanks for listening and remain excited. Bye-bye.